seated. I might be just having a look over the break, what our options are, should we not be able to, you know, finish at the indicated time at 2 o'clock today. What I can say is that the court won't put any questions to this witness. We'll hold those questions over until Cromwell, so that, you know, take us out of the frame. But if there's a cross-examination and the cross-examination hasn't finished, that's problematic, because otherwise Ms. Dysart's not able to talk to anyone for quite a while. We're looking to see if we can't push our flights out or other options around our flights. I know that I'm quite happy to fly out tomorrow. Commissioners are taking later flights anyway. That may buy some time, but everybody else is in the same position. You know, if you were needing to get home today.
Yes, so there was a discussion amongst council as to how we might best manage the time.
Yeah.
Ms. Dixon has indicated that she won't need much.
I don't want to rush your cross examination. This is a vital witness to the whole of the proceedings, so we are not pressing you for time. It'll take the time that it'll take. And if that impacts on us as a court and we're delaying our flights, flying out tomorrow, that's what we'll do. It's more how it impacts everybody else and whether everybody else is available.
I had indicated to Mr. Moore that a lot of the material that he was covering was material I would cover anyway. So that effectively means that I will need less time than I would have used, and he's welcome to use it.
He's welcome to use it. Okay, well, we'll see how we go. Just people think about their options. Yep. Okay. Good.
Thank you. All right. I want to circle back up to policy 10, capital A, 2.1. And I want to understand whether the wording you've put forward is achieving your intended outcome, where you've changed the tense there so it's a more positive grant resource consents. Mm-hmm. But as I read that policy, it says grant consents that replace the deemed permits, except where the deemed permit or water permit that is being replaced is a valid permit. Now, I just wanted to check that wasn't what you were intending.
No, that wasn't what I was intending.
So, again, that's just a grammatical issue which could be fixed
very
with
simply.
A little more time.
Sorry, which provision was this? Which policy?
10 capital A 2.1.
That's what I thought you said. Except slightly where it's valid. I see what you mean.
Slightly problematic.
It's a bit wonky, isn't it?
Thank you for picking that up, Mr. Moore.
Yeah, I won't put you on the spot to correct that drafting, but just the intention is that it applies to the replacement of the deemed permits.
That's right.
Very good. Right, we shall move on to what I'm going to refer to as the discretionary activity policy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And for the record, 10 capital A 2.3. And before the break, we had explored the duration, the 20 years, and we're now going to move on to each of the provisions. Now, I've relabeled my provisions so they're called with the clean copy, and I understand the nesting in terms of how that is to work. So I want to start with the first matter addressed there, where the application relates to a water body that contains threatened species likely to be affected by the activity. Now, the word likely, what are you driving at there? When I read the word likely, it's a little ambiguous. So can you tease out what you're trying to capture there? Is it all activities? Is it just activities that are taking water from tributaries or main stems with threatened species? What's the level of connection required?
Where there's an activity occurring in a water body that is also home to a threatened species, sometimes threatened species will be a long way upstream, so it wouldn't capture that situation. So it would capture where there's threatened species downstream of a water take, I would imagine, or affecting the environment in a way that oh, so sorry, rethinking that. If they are upstream and the water take is affecting the environment in the stream to the point that it's perhaps keeping trout away from the population upstream, then that could be relevant.
Right, so...
And so again, just pulling back for a second, you know, the I understand that you will take me through this word by word, but this is... will not be perfect drafting, as we've already established. So it's really about the intent of trying to focus a merits-based approach where there are threatened species, and undoubtedly this wording will be, you know, be able to be improved, and it would be great to have the opportunity to work with other planners on it.
So the important thing there is it's not that the water body contains threatened species, it's that the threatened species are likely to be affected by the activity.
That there's some kind of interaction going on.
And then we move on to what the policy is requiring, and that is that the application proposes measures to enhance or protect the habitat of the species. And so there's a difference between enhance and protect. Do you understand those two to be driving at different outcomes?
Different. Yes, those two words do have different connotations, but ultimately it's about looking after the threatened species. And if that may require some enhancement, or it may require a status quo. Enhancement might be, you know, putting in a trout barrier. It might be some riparian margin management. Or it could be about protecting the species from increased trout predation. So there are a whole raft of things, and wanting to leave it broad enough to encompass what might be necessary to look after the species in a particular location.
Might you find a situation where enhancement is interpreted to mean only a small bit of improvement is required?
By itself, yes, there's always that potential. But if somebody's going through this merits-based pathway within the context of PC7, I would anticipate that a decision maker with clear direction to look after and you know, there's a clear intent within the objective to look after the Indigenous species, that it would need to be sufficient enhancement.
So sufficient enhancement, what does that mean?
To ensure that species is looked after properly.
In the end, isn't that the same as what you might mean by protecting the habitat?
Protecting to me can mean just status quo sometimes, and I, you know, taking into account what Mr. Hickey says, status quo can be a dynamic thing in itself, whereas enhancement implies active, some kind of act. But they're not too dissimilar.
There's room for interpretation, though, in different approaches when you look at those two words, though, isn't there?
Yep.
And in terms of trying to achieve an outcome, there needs to be a level of precision that best avoids ambiguity in the drafting.
The less ambiguity is always the better in drafting, for sure.
Okay, let's move on to Roman 2. Where a water body or freshwater ecosystem is likely to be degraded or degrading.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is very broad when you read that. So when you refer to water body in that context, what are we talking about?
A water body, so a river, a lake, a stream.
An aquifer?
Potentially.
So you are...
Although this... Is this... Let me just go back to, so it's a replacement of consents. So surface water, we're talking about deemed permits, which is surface water, and then taking in use of surface water, including connected groundwater. But this policy, yes, could potentially be talking about an aquifer.
And then we move on to freshwater ecosystem. Very broad concept.
I think I used that wording, freshwater ecosystems, because it's coming out of Tier 1 from the National Policy Statement. So I was just trying to ensure consistency across documents there.
Right, and that concept included the wide range of values that aren't yet properly understood?
No, we've already covered this, I think, in relation to the objective, that it's going to have to be, at this stage, more of a science-based exercise, acknowledging that all that wider work still needs to happen, but that when there is sufficient information that informs us that there's degradation happening and we can do things to halt or reverse that degradation, that we can take action.
So what does a decision maker do with this limb of the policy in the short term? So without all of that information, what does a decision maker do?
Without all what information,
without,
sorry?
Without an understanding of the full extent of values, without an understanding of FMUs having even been established, without an understanding of what degradation or degrading means in the context of those FMUs?
I think FMUs have largely been identified in Otago. So we do know the FMU boundaries and the rohe within those.
Where would I find those boundaries?
They're online.
And do documents online have any status when considering an RMA document?
Well, they are ORC published FMUs and rohes, and I understand that that's the basis on which they're going out to communities and consulting on. But just coming back to the core part of your question, in terms of what does a decision maker do, a decision maker does, I think, what they always do is they're presented with evidence, with information as part of the application that would be assessed by the council. Other parties would be able to have a look at that information. So there would, as with any consenting process, there would be a significant amount of information that would be required to support that. And we have a lot of that information already sitting in behind the consent applications that have already had to be prepared under the operative plan.
So just because the information exists, isn't there a lack of clarity about the outcome, so the point to which improvement might need to occur? And that's going to be the work of the new land and water plan. So setting the targets, setting the limits.
Absolutely, that's the task of the new land and water plan. Yep.
And that's the frame of reference, isn't it? When you think about what's required to restore a water body to health, you need to understand what that frame of reference is before you can apply a policy such as this.
So in an ideal world, we'd have that in place already. Yes, that's right. I think, however, we have got a lot of information and a lot of guidance, and it's getting more specific with every version of the MPS about what we should be aiming for and what we should be looking at. So I think there's already a lot of information in there. And as I've said in my evidence, it's a step in the right direction.
The size of that step is mm-hmm. unknown, isn't it? Because as I read this part of the policy, all that's required is to propose some enhancement. So it could just be a very small element of enhancement in relation to perhaps one feature, and you'd then tick that limb of the policy.
So I've already answered a question on that earlier from you, in that within this context and within the science that would have to underpin that, within the context of the NPS, that we do have a lot of direction on a lot of guidance on the direction that we should be heading in. We've got national bottom lines, so if something's degrading towards or below our national bottom line, we know that we have to reverse that to bring it above a bottom line.
But the policy doesn't say anything about that, does it?
No, it doesn't. But what it does do, it uses the word degraded or degrading, and in the definition attached to this, it does try to acknowledge the issues with the use of the word degraded or degrading. This is problematic. This isn't easy. We haven't got NPS target attribute states in place yet. But in the meantime, we have got some environments that are degrading, and we have got some critically endangered Indigenous species.
So in the meantime, we shouldn't be granting consents for a 20-year permit when there's no understanding as to the outcome through the lens of the new NPS in terms of where environmental enhancement needs to reach.
I think it's pretty clear that if we've got an endangered or threatened Indigenous species, that is something that we need to focus on, and we may not have the benefit of 6 or more years to deal with that when we know that the activities involved have interactions with those species that could be critical.
And so perhaps that highlights that what you really have in mind here is a concern over the threatened Indigenous species. And this wording, when I read it, is very, very broad and could capture a whole raft of different ecological considerations or values. And the proposition I'm putting to you is that it will be very difficult for a decision maker to sift through this wording to understand what the intention is.
I think with scientific information to support an application and an assessment of that information by ORC science staff, it would be there would be many cases where you could clearly, from a scientific standpoint, identify where there's degradation occurring.
So it's clear from the science where cultural indicators of health may indicate degradation?
No, and I've already made it clear that that's something that definitely has to come in through the full expression of Te Mana o Te Wai in Otago. So this is really a starting point where we can't afford to wait.
Right, let's move on to Roman 3, where measures to achieve protection or enhancement in Roman 1 or 2 are necessary. So we're adding a further test now in terms of necessity in relation to those earlier two paragraphs. So what is it you're trying to capture in terms of adding a further layer or a further test?
So it's if 1 or 2 exist, then these are the things that you might need to do to look after 1 or 2 or to achieve 1 or 2.
So you're not intending to add an additional test of saying simply because they are likely, they also need to be necessary. You're not intending to add
no,
a
so
layer?
No, so it's more you've established that there are threatened species likely to be affected by the activity and the application is trying to address that there's degradation happening. So you've established those circumstances, then you need to consider measures such as fish passage, fish screens, flow limits.
Right, so let's look at should and consider. You'd accept should is not a mandatory obligation?
No, and it's include, so it's a non-exhaustive list.
And then we move on to consideration. So all that's required is consideration.
That's right, because the circumstances may be that, for example, fish screens may not shouldn't be on the intake infrastructure. Maybe they should be further up a race system. So it's allowing some flexibility in your response, because it will have to be a targeted response specific to the degradation or the risk in that particular location. So that was really the intent behind that. I'm sure that the drafting of it could be improved.
So it wasn't your intention that an applicant could record in their application, I've considered these factors, I'm not going to do anything about them, so we ticked the policy because that was all I was required to do.
Mm-hmm. A little bit like having regard to a document shouldn't be a tick box exercise.
No, but that's you can right. See how that argument could be run through this wording.
I think if an applicant's going to go down this pathway, I would anticipate that a decision maker would give it, apply some critical thinking to that.
Well, and this is where the danger or the challenge with the drafting comes in. Decision makers haven't the benefit of the hearing where the intention sitting behind these policies
is
expressed. So it's really important to capture that really accurately and clearly in the policy.
That's right. Yeah.
I does also say, to be fair, when I'm reading all of the relief, I am thinking at the same time, if something came before me on appeal, how would I apply it? I'm always thinking that in these sorts of hearings, and I think the points that Mr. Moore is making is a fair point.
And that's where I acknowledge the drafting is, I'm not saying it's perfect by any means. So really trying to put out a concept and a clear intent of where an application, where it could be considered acceptable to consider an application on its merits.
And even in that phrase, where it could be considered acceptable, I think this is where the tightness of the language needs to become really important. But in terms of understanding the intent behind the wording, the explanation is assisting in terms of what you had in mind. Mm-hmm. Right, want to move on to Roman 4 now. The application enables and is part of an integrated management approach. Now, I want to understand the intention here. Is this a mandatory requirement so that the only way to get access to the discretionary activity pathway is if the application enables and is part of an integrated management approach?
Yes.
So that's essentially an entry condition into the discretionary activity consideration?
Essentially, yes, it is. And so that will have the effect of blocking this pathway for some applicants. I'm not quite sure whether I've landed on it correctly here with my intent. Trying to set the bar high again, incentivising a controlled activity pathway, there does need to be a bar, and the bar does need to be set at the right level to go down a merits for a merits-based pathway.
Is this controlled activity pathway or discretionary?
No, the bar around the discretionary activity or any merits-based pathway needs to be set at the right height to incentivise the controlled activity pathway. But I was trying to capture circumstances where we might need to act faster, or it would be better to act now rather than wait. And there may be situations, I might not have struck the balance right, there may be situations where there is an isolated take on an isolated trip with a critical population of galaxids. So that also needs to be thought about.
Okay, so let's explore this a little. So you intended this to be an entry criteria to the discretionary activity role. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes.
wouldn't it be better to put that in the discretionary activity rule from a drafting perspective? Because the danger here might be that an application comes in that's not part of one of these, we call them integrated management groups.
Yeah.
And a decision maker is then left with some potential confusion as to whether this limb of the policy should just be put to one side or not, as simply not being relevant.
So it was something that I considered and played around with. It was very hard to develop something that was clear-cut enough to put into a rule.
Right, so it's the difficulty in drafting it with the precision necessary to be an entry condition that's causing the challenge?
Entry condition in a rule. I think in a policy it sits better in a policy, that approach.
All right, let's explore the sub-paragraph, starting with A, part of a coordinated catchment or sub-catchment-based approach. So what's the expectation in terms of membership or participation? Is it enough that two deemed permit holders get together and say we'll form our own integrated management group? Or is it broader than that? Is it a whole of catchment, a whole of sub-catchment?
I think I have tried to define subcatchment. It's on page 53. So it means a tributary of a lake, the Clutha River or Tairi River, or a section of the main stem of these rivers that is able to be managed to a downstream flow limit. So it's trying to capture. So in essence, yes, it could be two people on one tributary, and that might be an effective and important way to manage values of that are critical.
Is it all permit holders in a sub-catchment, or is a subset of sufficient?
I'd like it to be all. I think if you've got above, yeah, and again, you could have some kind of threshold here. There does need to be a very significant uptake for it to be effective. Although, also, if you've got one or two outliers, it doesn't necessarily matter as much.
It's difficult to capture that in the drafting, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Staying with A, it's not drafted in the current wording as requiring minimum standards or criteria. It uses the word including. So those are not mandatory considerations.
Sorry, what do you mean there?
So, second line, management of surface water, including through flow sharing membership in a water management group and imposition of flow limits. So are those both requirements for this to be a valid option, or are those just matters that need to be considered?
So that's to be read after the words as a minimum at the end of Roman, the start of Roman numeral 4. So including as a minimum being part of a coordinated catchment or subcatchment based approach, including through flow sharing membership in a water management group and impositions of flow limits. So it's all of those things.
Right. And in terms of the flow limits, those are to be derived by the applicant in terms of what's being proposed?
And scrutinised by the regional council, who would recommend, grant or decline, and no doubt input from other parties as well. But yes, it would be proposed by the applicant.
Let's move through to B. Here the requirement is simply consideration of the impact of land use, and we've had a discussion around what simply having to consider something might mean.
Yeah.
So the same would apply here.
That's right, and we heard from Dr. Olson yesterday that we've got quite good, or in his opinion, a lot of information to support an understanding about where land use management might be critical with regard to the use of water. So that will help inform that.
So you're anticipating that the full range of effects associated with water takes will be considered through this discretionary activity framework?
It certainly allows for that through farm environmental planning. That takes in a broad range of effects from the land use.
Chapter 10A doesn't have any policy guidance in relation to how those effects should be managed, though, does it?
No, it doesn't.
And we've also heard that the regional plan water is not fit for purpose and doesn't contain such controls at present?
No, it doesn't. And again, this is where national bottom lines and target attribute states will be helpful in the meantime. And as Dr. Olson said, there's a lot of information on this already. With all of our applications, we've assessed water quality and we've already got recommendations as to where land use or irrigation type might need to be changed. Those changes can't be made, is my understanding, within a short-term time frame because they require upgrades of infrastructure. So we know in some places that contour flooding or border diking is having an issue. We know that, you know, in other places stock access needs to be managed better, etc. So there's a lot of knowledge and clarity around that already, and that's one of the huge gains in going through a specific consenting process is you do get to analyse that information and...
But how do you know what's required in terms of, say, an improvement in a degraded catchment? How do you know what level you need to get to without those limits having been established in the planning framework?
We know what direction we need to head in. We need to do better. We know that if there's contaminants being washed off from border diking, it's well established and well understood, is my understanding, within the scientific community, that that can result in contaminants entering waterways. So there is a lot of understanding out there.
Do you accept that there's a lot of understanding as to the cause and effect, but no real clarity yet as to the level of improvement required?
Not exactly how high that bar is going to be set, absolutely, but we can at least head in the right direction.
All right, let's move on to the subparagraph C, and that's the requirement to insert the minimum flows from Schedule 2A in the relevant catchments. So your intention is that those become, or the Schedule 2A flow regime becomes the flow regime for this 20-year period?
Yes, although I do anticipate, and I've said this repeatedly, that a review under Section 128 could be utilised as well.
We will come to review conditions in the fullness of time.
I'm sure.
So I'll pick that up at that point. You're aware of the limitations of the Schedule 2A limits, though, that they're a function of the previous regime. They weren't set under the current NPSFM?
No, but they did go through a high degree of scrutiny. One of them is very recent. The Lindis was set under the... I'm trying to think which NPS it was. Commissioner Edmonds may be able to help me with that. But one of the more recent NPSFMs. And I am aware that other minimum flows did go through an intensive environment court process.
In your mind, has there been much of a shift in terms of water management when you read the NPSFM 2020 compared to the previous iterations?
I think between the 2017 and the latest version, Te Mana o Te Wai has been brought front and centre, and so that's a continuation of trying to bring Te Mana o Te Wai forward in terms of freshwater planning.
The phrase a paradigm shift has been used.
Mm-hmm.
Do you accept that that's what has occurred?
I think that's what is intended, yes. I don't know if it's occurred yet.
And that shift will be given colour and its full expression in the new land and water regional plan?
Yes.
And so simply bringing forward limits set under previous regimes wouldn't reflect that paradigm shift?
No, absolutely not. And this is, again, it's a stop. It's really a stopgap measure where we need to act sooner rather than later.
Okay, let's move on to Roman 5. The application, including the duration of any replacement consent, is consistent with any timeframe set out in the regional policy statement to meet Te Mana or Te Wai objectives relevant to the activity. Now, I've looked at the regional policy statement and I can't see any reference to timeframes to meet Te Mana or Te Wai. So, what is it?
Very much anticipating. Sorry, that was intended to speak to the new RPS.
Right, so that should be referencing set out in a proposed regional policy statement?
Yeah, and we've covered this off already as well. I acknowledge that it will be proposed rather than operative, and so it does still have a process to go through. Hopefully that will be a speedy process through the freshwater process.
How do you assess the efficiency and effectiveness of a provision relying on a document the contents of which are unknown?
That's a good point. So I guess I'm trying to speak again. When I talked about the term, I acknowledged it was difficult to land on a term, and that is really a nod towards that.
Is it your understanding that a regional policy statement will set out the detail steps required to achieve a long-term vision?
Is it my understanding what, sorry?
That a regional policy statement will include the individual steps required to achieve the long-term vision?
I don't know. I haven't seen.
I'll perhaps put it this way. Isn't the purpose of the RPS to set the long-term visions, but the Land and Water Regional Plan, its function is to then work out how to get to that vision? So the
yes.
Detailed steps will be set out in the Land and Water Plan.
That's what I'd anticipate, yes.
So when we think about understanding the timing and the steps required to meet a long-term objective, it's actually the timing that the Land and Water Plan is going to contain that's important to understand, as opposed to simply the long-term frame of reference?
It depends how the RPS is set out. It depends whether it's got just one end date or whether it's got dates in between. But the two documents will be essential in terms of giving full effect to Te Mano Te Wai.
And so some care will need to be required with how that concept is expressed at a policy level at this point in time.
Yes.
In fact, a decision maker could be left with no information on which to interpret that policy.
Yes, if this was made operative before a notification of the RPS, it would be troublesome.
When you think about that time frame, and let's test, for example, that the period of time that the RPS or the proposed RPS says that, say, improvement needs to be met is a 20-year time frame. If you were seeking to obtain a consent under this discretionary activity pathway, would you go about that exercise of coding into the permit the achievement of that long-term vision by year 20? Or how would you approach it? What is it doing?
So you're saying in the circumstance that the RPS does, by chance, I've struck the right number, and it says sets out a 20-year time frame to meet a certain outcome, I would anticipate that there may still need to be a review if the new land and water regional plan arrives at somewhere very different than that consent has arrived at, then there may still need to be a review of that consent.
Would you be aiming at that long-term vision in the consent, or would you take the approach that that doesn't need to be achieved for 20 years, so the consent doesn't need to address it?
So that's not what's written into this policy. The policy is not saying that it's going to achieve long-term visions as such. It's just the time frame consistency that it was trying to achieve there.
So you're
because
trying
I don't
to...
know what those visions are yet.
Right, so and this again highlights some of the challenges with the drafting. So it's all about consistency with time frames, but not about time... It's not about achieving the outcomes. That's a separate
That's right. It's, as I've already said, it's very much trying to achieve a step in the right direction where we know that we have to take steps right now, or that we should be taking steps right now, and we've got the information to support that.
Not sure that that was your question.
No, it wasn't my question.
But your question again, it was important.
Right. When we look at the wording here, you say consistent with any time frames in the, and we now should read that as proposed regional policy statement. And you've said to the court that what you had in mind when you used the words consistent with time frames
mm-hmm.
is simply aligning duration with consent. It's not about achieving the outcomes.
Yes. That part of the policy is not about outcomes.
And so the outcomes or the achievement of the long-term vision wouldn't be attained through that time period. That's something for the next consent.
I've said already that I would anticipate a review might have to take place to attain that. It depends where this consent, any consent granted under this lands, and how that compares with what comes out of the Land and Water Regional Plan.
Right. We'll move on to the next sub-paragraph, and that relates to the allocation proposed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's driven by your Schedule 10A5 and 10A5 in both instances. Now, those schedules are the subject of conferencing
mm-hmm.
and a joint witness statement has issued.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had time to consider that in any detail, so I'll park any questions in relation to that for another day. But in terms of what you're trying to achieve here is providing information as to what the allocation rates should be.
Yep. So it's the lesser of either the rate and volume as assessed under that methodology or an efficient volume of order.
So neither of those two requirements would have the effect of understanding how much water is actually available for allocation?
No, it's not targeted at that.
So it's not about setting an allocation block?
No.
And in fact, when you work through these conditions, there's nothing requiring consideration of the appropriate size of an allocation block?
No, because that still has to happen. Sitting in behind this, though, is still the framework of the operative plan, where allocation blocks and 2A catchments would still exist. So that still exists in behind PC7.
So now I'm confused again as to whether those provisions are relevant in relation to an application considered under Chapter 10A.
So they're not relevant to these ones, but those allocation blocks still exist in terms of the other rules in the plans that are still at play, which means it's a prohibited activity to apply for new water in those allocation blocks.
Right, but isn't this policy dealing with the renewal of deemed permits, not applications for new water?
Yes, I was just merely saying that sits in the background. It's just background context.
So those allocation blocks have no relevance to the discretionary activity framework you've produced in your evidence?
They do in a sense that the whole of plan structure allows for the replacement of permits where they've existed before a cut-off date. They get the benefit of being within that allocation block and being allowed to replace their existing permit, whereas new permit holders can't come in and apply for more water out of that block. So that's just, it's just really black background.
Yeah, so let's put new water to one side. It's, I think what you're saying is it's simply rolling over the existing allocation.
That's right, yeah.
Without reference to consideration as to the appropriate size of an allocation block.
That's right, yeah.
Right, on to the last subparagraph, Roman 8. And this relates to the level of investment required. And here you say that to exercise a requirement, and let's start at the beginning, is it a mandatory requirement, this?
Sorry, are you at to exercise the replacement water permit?
Yes.
Yep. This is substantial investment one. Is that what you're looking at?
Yes.
Yep. And the question was, is this a mandatory requirement?
Correct.
Yes.
Might the language be sharpened to capture that if that is the intention?
Yes, it could be.
Right, let's look at the wording then and what the test is. And that is require substantial investment in new infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've explained to me that there's significant complexity understanding how much land somebody's irrigating. How is it that we understand what substantial investment in new infrastructure means?
Sorry, I'm just making a note of a thought before I lose it. I'll come back to... about the drafting there. The controlled activity rule used that, and there was a proof requirement, and with the controlled activity pathway, consent must be granted, and I was concerned about lack of clarity within that pathway around what proof might or might not be accepted, and what it was adding in terms of more substantive kind of assessment if we're going for a simple controlled activity pathway. This is a far more merits-based, this is a merits-based pathway under a discretionary activity rule. So there's room for more consideration.
So when we,
what might not be substantial improvement or investment, sorry.
Do you foresee significant room for argument as to what substantial investment in new infrastructure actually means?
There could be room for, we're often talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, we're often talking millions of dollars being invested by applicants, but yes, there could be room. And I just was making a note because in terms of it being a mandatory requirement, again, I'm not sure if I've landed, that is how it's drafted, but I'm not sure whether that is how it should be, because again, if the focus is on, well, my intent was focused on looking after Indigenous species and dealing with degradation, where there is clear degradation, then this may actually rule out some permit holders from taking this pathway. And actually, if it's about looking after Indigenous species, then maybe it shouldn't be a mandatory requirement. I'm not sure. I haven't fully got there in my head yet with that.
So one of the reasons you say long-term consents are required is because of the cost of investment
yes.
in infrastructure to then enable the protection
changes.
Mechanisms to be put in place for threatened species.
Yep.
So
and that's why that is in there, yeah.
So therefore it ought to be a mandatory consideration.
Yes. Yeah, but I don't want to lose a population of galaxids if just because somebody doesn't pass this test. So there's...
The risk then is...
It's tricky.
It becomes wide open for every applicant, though.
Yes, that is the risk.
For a long-term permit.
Yeah.
Sorry, is the last answer to the last question... I wasn't quite tracking where you were going with this, that you want to protect galaxids even if the investment's not substantial.
If a population of galaxids needs protection, then I think we have to facilitate that as much as possible. And if this creates a barrier and it means somebody chooses the controlled activity pathway and a population is put at risk because they've chosen, you know, we've incentivised them to take the simple rollover and do nothing, then, yeah, that might put that species at risk. So this is the difficulty.
Well, it's the difficulty that's been created where one species is selected for preferential treatment above all other species. You know, quite why that should be so, I don't know, but there again, there we go.
Why they should be selected above others? Because I understand from the evidence that we may not necessarily have 6 years for some of these populations to get ourselves sorted out.
That's not the answer. I understand what the risks are to this species. I don't understand why it is that the provisions that you are proposing are preferring one species above all other species, which might also... be exposed to risks associated with farming. And I understand the strategy, I just don't understand where the policy's going.
And that's where the degradation factor comes into play as well.
So anyway, just to recap, what's your answer? What are we actually getting here with substantial investment? I didn't follow it, so what's the point of putting this in?
It acknowledges that in many cases changes on farm are required. When we go through these consenting processes, there are often significant changes that need to happen, and those changes to meet a flow limit that's put in place to protect the environment that drives changes on farm, and those changes can only happen with a longer term of consent in terms of securing investment to allow those changes to happen.
So is it your policy that there should be any catchment or sub-catchment with a threatened or nationally critical population of galaxids should not go via the controlled activity rule but should go via a discretionary rule? Is that where you're driving?
That's an option available to them.
No, that's actually what's in the provisions. I thought that's where you were driving. You wouldn't want to lose the chance of protecting the galaxids via the controlled activity rule, correct?
Yes.
So therefore, anything that has any catchment or sub-catchment with a threatened species or a nationally endangered, what's the label? If we call them threatened species, and any catchment, sub-catchment, cannot be controlled, must go through a discretionary route. I think that's what your evidence was.
The controlled is still available to anybody, but if they meet all the criteria, so somebody who, or a group of applicants who know that they're are Indigenous species at play, could go down the merits-based pathway under this policy framework.
Right,
okay. Just to finish off, substantial investment.
Mm-hmm.
You accept that there's significant room for subjective interpretation of that term?
Yes.
I wonder whether we might move through to the controlled activity rule now. Now, I'm still working through my blue version, page 24. At the top of the page there, there's some strikeout text in relation to irrigated land area. Just for the record, that should have some grey shading over as well. That's a change that you've recommended.
Which page are you looking at?
Top of page 24.
If that was still in Mr. De Pelsmaker's version. I think I did, yes.
Yes, right, so it should just be shaded grey.
Yes.
That's a deletion.
Mm-hmm.
And that deletion follows on from the discussion that we had earlier.
Yes.
In the context of the policy.
That's right.
So we need not explore that territory again. Likewise, the deletion of the rate of take, same reasoning there as we discussed in relation to the policy.
Yep.
And then on to Roman 4. You've made some additions here in relation to priorities.
Yes.
Now, there's been quite some discussion in court over the last couple of weeks about priorities, and I wonder whether you might be able to assist us with your knowledge in terms of priorities. In your experience, have priorities been exercised or is there a range of degree of exercise of those priorities?
It's yes to both of those. Yes. So I know of situations where they have been critically important between users on a tributary, including the situation where the higher priority is downstream and calls off somebody with a lower priority who's upstream. I'm aware of other situations where they're kind of used, but not to the strict kind of you must always turn off when I want my water. So there's a real range in there.
So practically, how does it work on the ground? So does the person with higher priority simply call up the person with lower priority and say, switch off, I need some water?
Yes, not always switch off. It's often a dial back. So that too can vary. Sometimes there might be taking turns. I want my water today because I'm doing X with my water. Or it could be, can you dial your water by X back by X amount because I need more to be getting through to me.
So we've heard some evidence that there can be an environmental consequence, a positive consequence in relation to water being left in a river which might be sustaining a fish population as a result of the exercise of these priorities. That would be a byproduct of the exercise of the priorities, not the intention or the purpose of those priorities. Is that how you understand it?
Yes, historically, absolutely.
And there's no requirement for a person with a permit which has high priority to take water?
No.
And so that byproduct is, in terms of environmental gain, is just simply something which might happen as a result of exercise of priorities?
Yes.
So when you've added priorities back into the controlled activity framework, what's the purpose for you doing so?
It's twofold. It's to capture those examples that you've just talked about. It's those environmental aspects, I acknowledge they're a byproduct, but priorities have had a huge influence on flow characteristics. And if we simply drop them by the wayside without understanding and fully assessing what those impacts on the flow characteristics and therefore the environment are, then there is a risk associated with that. The other aspect is the sense of balance, or I'm not sure if balance is quite the right word, that currently exists between those priority holders. If we simply remove them and replace them with nothing and do not go through a full assessment of how water has or could be shared or should be shared between those parties, then it could be quite chaotic.
Is it your experience that the priorities have been brought down into replacement consents?
In terms of the current replacements?
Yes.
They're a huge part of the background context that we have to, not even background, sorry, the context that we have to work through when developing an application. And I was looking through the evidence of Ms McKeague, and she actually goes into quite a bit of detail about what we do and how it can take years from kind of first meeting with applicants, and we do quite a lot of group-based work. So working with them, understanding how they have used water in the past, including with their priorities, whether they've utilised priorities, how important they've been, and then through the reconsenting process, there is either an agreement to carry them forward in a different way, and it's or let them go, and it can be a combination of both within one application. So within one application, you can. Where I've seen someone with a high priority actually just let it go for the kind of the greater good of how that catchment's going to work, and delivering a residual flow.
So if you think about looking at this through the lens of risk, in your opinion, it would be more risky in terms of the byproduct consequences on the environment for the priority system to be lost in relation to the short-term rollover of permits.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, moving down, you've crossed out the last two entry conditions, the first of which relates to the volumes of water. And we spoke briefly in relation to the policy considerations, but presumably the same reasoning applies as to why you've removed those volumes.
Yes.
And then you've also deleted Roman 7. Why have you deleted that?
My understanding was that subparagraph was there as an offset for the other subparagraphs which dealt with the rate and the volume were explicitly about recorded takes, and so then something was added to capture takes that hadn't been recorded. And so by taking out the subparagraphs which dealt with recorded takes, there was no need to have a subparagraph which dealt with takes that weren't recorded. So that just kind of followed.
So a consequential deletion.
That's right.
For the same reasons in yep. relation to the instantaneous rate of take and volumes, etc.
Yes.
Well, we needn't traverse that again. Right, I want to move on to the matters of control now. Now, you've inserted subparagraph A here, but you've deleted what was subparagraph C. Is there a reason behind what I think you're capturing the same sentiment, but expressing it in different wording?
Yeah, so the deleted one, are you talking about intake method and flow rate controls to avoid or mitigate fish entrainment?
No, I'm referring to the first matter of control, matters covered by the conditions of the existing deemed permit or water permit being replaced.
Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm looking at the right matters covered by...
So that's at the bottom of page 24.
Yeah, and it's underlined, so I've... added that one.
Yes, and then you've deleted on the next page, three quarters of the way down, what was a subparagraph C, which is in blue and grey shading.
Other conditions. Sorry, I'm with you now. Yep. Any other conditions on the expiring permit?
Yes.
Yep. Any other conditions? Yes, and that a little bit of a consequential deletion there, because that was written within the context of other matters of control.
Right, so because you have no other matters of control, you've just had your only matter of control being the existing conditions.
Yeah.
So that's the genesis of,
yes.
of that addition.
And that strike through, yeah.
So then as we track down through all of the deletions here, the reasoning, I presume, again, follows from the discussions we've had in relation to the policy. So removing out the matter of control relating to historic take, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Then we head down towards the bottom of the page, and you've also struck out the matter of control relating to review conditions. Is that because you don't think review conditions are important and or appropriate?
No, sorry, that should remain, shouldn't it?
That's your evidence.
Particularly, so. Yes, no. Particularly as I am promoting the use of a review as a tool.
Yes, I promised we'd get there, and we will get there. You would undelete your deletion in relation to review conditions?
Yes, sorry.
Is compliance monitoring type conditions, are those important too?
Yeah, they can go on. That's, yeah.
And the final strike out there, the point of method of measurement and the method for transmitting recorded data to council.
Yep, that can go on.
And you understand these are fairly standard conditions that tend to get put on in terms of these sorts of matters.
Yeah.
And they are important. Right, then we move through to the discretionary activity. I don't want necessarily to work through the rule, but I want you to have a think about how this framework might work for an activity seeking a longer-term permit that's not one of these farming or irrigation-type permits. So when I read through your policy considerations, they are all directed at one particular type of water use. Mm-hmm. And if Mr. Welsh was here, he might well ask you, well, what does this discretionary activity mean for other activities such as hydroelectricity generation?
Yes.
So was it your intention to not provide for any activities in your discretionary activity pathway other than the activities which could fit through your mandatory criteria in the policy?
That's a yes, but I did talk in my supplementary evidence. I did acknowledge renewable energy generation and drinking water, and that potentially there might need to be a carve out for them. I am aware that dams in particular need to be thought about quite carefully. Where I landed with that was a lot of the dams that I'm aware of that are coming up, and there may be some others that I'm not so familiar with, that are coming up for renewal would be doing so on a catchment-wide basis, and so may be able to take the discretionary activity pathway with that policy in there.
So you see a dam fitting within that framework, or that was your intention?
Potentially.
But a dam for irrigation-related takes? Or a hydroelectricity dam?
No, sorry, I'm talking now about dams for irrigation takes.
So dams for irrigations fit through the discretionary activity pathway, is that what you're saying?
That if they're in with a catchment management approach, they could use that pathway.
Some challenges with your wording, though, in relation to capturing the likes of damming, because the language refers to water permits in various places.
Mm.
So you would need to make adjustments to capture.
Potentially, yes.
Except that dams have very different effects from in-stream abstraction?
Yes, they do.
And the matters you've addressed in your policy don't perhaps pick up on those differences?
So just going back a step, The policy does refer to deemed permits, and the only dams that are actually caught with this interim framework are dams authorised by deemed permits. So in terms of your comment about water permits and refinement, I think I've used the same language as the ORC there. So dams that are authorised by a deemed permit are captured in the introductory part of that policy.
I was looking more precisely at subparagraph Roman 8, to exercise the replacement water permit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. So that could be better expressed as deemed permit.
I want to move over to the non-complying activity. And there you have inserted a requirement or a further passage of text which envisages a longer term permit, so a permit expiring after 1 October 2041.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pathway is then available for 35-year permits, albeit through the non-complying activity.
Yes.
And when that activity is being assessed, which policies would you be looking at in terms of informing the duration, the appropriate duration for such a permit?
It would have to go back to the discretionary activity policy, and I know there's it would be helpful to have a specific policy in there. This was really a time frame drafting limitation. Also, the other activities that could go into the non-complying activity pathway would be something that didn't meet the discretionary activity policy as well. So that's not necessarily a longer term than 20 years, but it might not meet the other aspects of the discretionary activity pathway.
You accept that there's a significant gap in your drafting in relation to the policy framework informing consent duration for the non-complying activities?
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to have a policy that directs.
And this is perhaps
guidance.
Picked up, and we spoke earlier about the gap in relation to the 6 years. So the policy saying avoid granting consents for more than 6 years has disappeared from your framework.
Yep.
And as a consequence, the door's wide open for a non-complying activity, isn't it?
Yeah, the problems with speed drafting and isolation.
Right, over to page 30, onto the definitions. Now, you have endeavoured to provide some clarity around what degraded or degrading means, and you have referred to the NPSFM definitions. And I think you've acknowledged that until the target attribute states have been identified for each of the values, then there's a problem with relying solely on those definitions.
Mm-hmm.
So you have then explained that those words have their ordinary meaning informed by te mana or te wai. Now, I recognise you've tried to provide some clarity there, but what is it? How does a decision maker seek to apply that definition when te mana or te wai in its full expression hasn't yet been determined in this region?
So again, it's coming back to what we do have available to us at the moment, and that is where we have robust science that can tell us as a starting point whether an ecosystem, a freshwater ecosystem, is healthy or not, particularly when compared to the attributes outlined in the NPS and national bottom lines.
There would be some challenges with applying this in the short term, though, wouldn't there?
Yep, it wouldn't be easy.
And then we move on to the schedules, and I'm not going to ask you any questions about the schedules.
I'm very glad about that.
The optimist in me is expecting great things from our joint witness conferencing, but time will tell. Right. Final topic that I wish to explore with you is the question of reliance on the consent review pathway, if I can describe it in that term. So, is it fair to say that you're of the opinion that the new framework in the land and water regional plan can be brought down into permits that have been granted for an extended period of time, so let's say your discretionary 20-year permits, through the council simply reviewing the conditions of consent?
I think in some cases that will have to occur, and particularly in the Tairi catchment.
So that relates to permits that have already been granted, so permits that aren't the subject of this plan change.
Yep.
So I want to focus on the permits that might be granted under your discretionary activity pathway. So is it your opinion that the review mechanism in Section 128 gives sufficient power to the council to implement its land and water plan in a timely manner?
I think it assists the council with transitioning permits granted for a longer term time frame towards the outcomes that might be set in that land and water regional plan. So it might not take permit holders the whole way there. In some cases it might. It might be as simple as applying a new limit. Depending on where those limits might land, some of them may not be different or markedly different from what we already have in place. Some may be, but it will be a useful way of transitioning permit holders. And the other thing I'd just note as well is what we've seen to date is that when targets or outcomes are set in a plan, people start moving towards those before their permit expires or before they're due to replace their permit. So we've seen a huge shift in the last 10 years in Otago in anticipation of what people thought they were required to do, including more efficient forms of infrastructure, including water storage, and including flow sharing towards limits. The Tairi is another good example of that, where a limit has been set, the review hasn't yet happened, but people are already actively flow sharing to that limit.
So let's just press pause there for a moment. So if it's the community mindset that the community will work towards that limit, irrespective of whether it's included as a condition of consent at any point in time, so pre-review or pre-renewal.
Are you asking me? Was that a question? Sorry.
I'm still trying to frame my question.
Oh sorry. Perhaps that doesn't always happen.
There's a risk helpful. Let's break it down a little. There's a risk that it won't happen.
Yes, there is a risk that it won't happen.
And that risk is borne then by the environment.
Yes. And that's where review is powerful.
And when you think about reviews and councils exercising that power, it's a discretionary power. It's not a mandatory requirement.
It's not a mandatory requirement for the council to undertake a review? Is that...
That's the
yes,
question?
Yes, yep, yep.
And so again, who bears the risk of the council exercising its discretion for review? So let's say the council doesn't exercise its power of review, then again the environment bears that risk, doesn't it?
That's right, and if they do undertake the... it's a little bit both ways, because I think permit holders are now very aware of this process and the setting of limits and the discussion around allocation, and so they are aware that what they get granted on their permit today is not what they might have on their permit in the long term.
So when you think about that, if the mindset is that there are limits coming and that those limits could be imposed reasonably swiftly once the new land and water plan comes to fruition, and holders of permits have prepared themselves for that shift, why is it that they need a long-term permit?
Got every kind of person in the rural community. So some people, people respond to things in very different ways. Some people have an appetite for risk, some don't. Some carry a lot of debt, some don't. Some have succession plans. So there's a huge variety of responses. We have seen a significant shift in anticipation of reconsenting, in particular because they're actually active in that reconsenting process. And I think the community thought they understood what was expected of them. But then there are other people who don't want to extend themselves or don't want to take the risk just yet and would rather wait and see where limits are set, what allocation, what they would get replaced on their permit. So there's a variety of responses.
So that's risk from the water user's perspective.
Yeah.
I want you to think about what the risk matrix looks like from the environment's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So in light of the range of approaches for those who hold permits, isn't it the environment that takes the risk when it comes to long-term permits?
It depends what conditions are put in those long-term permits.
Well, we know that those permits are unlikely to have the limits that the new land and water plan is going to express because we haven't yet had those limits expressed.
Mm-hmm.
So insofar as there's a significant difference between the land and water plan limits and what's coded into a permit, then it's the environment that takes the risk in terms of review or no review or outcome of review.
Yes, and that's why I would hope that we would see a review undertaken.
Right, that's probably enough from me. Thank you. No further questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Winchester.
Thank you, Mark. Good afternoon, Ms. Dicey.
Good afternoon.
Just first question, and it relates to some matters Mr. Moore explored with you, and you talked about a huge shift of thinking in Otago and a change in mindset. You've lodged a lot of renewal applications,
mm-hmm.
haven't you?
Mm-hmm. I have.
And how many of those seek less than a 35-year term?
Very few. Mm. And I think within the context of uncertainty with the regional water plan and PC7 and not knowing where PC7 was going to land, I think there was a little bit of risk management in terms of that approach.
Well,
in relation to the applicants, from an applicant's perspective.
Right. You say very few. Are there any that you have lodged that seek less than a 35-year term?
I think our company has.
Right. Thank you. Now, I just want to ask you some questions about the discretionary activity policy and pathway, and I may return to them. They are matters at the top of mind at the moment. Is it your intention that the discretionary activity pathway should only be available where the habitat of a threatened species is available and the water is degrading? Or is it generally available?
The intent was to capture those situations so that it's available to people where those situations are at play.
Right. And only then?
Yes.
I see. So you've got a detailed policy which Mr. Moore has talked you through, but you then have a rule for discretionary activities with no entry conditions, don't you?
Yes, and I did, again, I tried to frame some entry conditions.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Now, when you think about your role as a planning expert, do you understand that it's your role to produce evidence or give recommendations which are based on the best result for the clients or for all users and stakeholders?
For all users and stakeholders.
Right. And I take it from that answer that that's what you've sought to do in this process. So
yes.
The rule that you and the frameworks that you have promoted are intended to address the interests of all users.
Yes, and in terms of users and stakeholders, I think, you know, it's really the primary kind of, it's the purpose of the Act, it's the MPSFM, etc.
All right. So, with the framework that you've advanced in your supplementary statement, do you say that better represents the interests of all users than what you initially promoted?
I think it's really focused on environmental aspects. I don't think it's, in my opinion, it cuts out a number of water users from taking that pathway because of those entry, that intent around the entry criteria in terms of the focus is on Indigenous species and degrading habitats or waterways. And it also acknowledges it doesn't serve all other stakeholders either. So it's really about just what could be critical environmentally right now.
All right. And your summary of evidence acknowledged that the regional water plan doesn't adequately address Te Manawatu Wai or iwi interests.
Yes.
Doesn't it? And you'd agree that what you recommended in your evidence in chief doesn't address those matters either, does it?
No. And it was very much about taking the ability to take a step in the right direction, but fully acknowledging that we can't give full expression to Te Manawatu Wai until that's brought into the plan.
Yes. And your latest framework has no regard for mana whenua interests either, does it?
No, and I did think about pulling that into the policy, and as I said to Mr. Moore, I'd be open to the inclusion of something in there.
Yes, I think your words were you are open to working on drafting, but that you don't see a need to address cultural matters. That's what you said.
And that was within the context of it's really about acting at the moment. All we can really act on is the scientific basis because we haven't had that full participation by iwi in the process to date.
All right. And in terms of other potential stakeholders in water, your framework doesn't address the interests of recreational users, does it?
No.
Now, you accept now in your supplementary statement and in your summary of evidence today that an interim framework is necessary. Why the change in view? You haven't explained that.
I thought I had actually covered that, and I'm sorry if I haven't explained that fully enough.
All right.
So I was just thinking where to start, sorry. So I accept that the RD rule, the restricted discretionary pathway, is problematic, particularly for iwi interests. I was very concerned with the notified version of Plan Change 7 and even the amended, I think it was 4th of March version of PC 7, that didn't provide a pathway at all for some applicants, or a very difficult pathway for applicants. And so that was critical to my stance at that time.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So implicit in that is an acceptance that in Otago, with regard to the water framework, a significant reset is required. There's no dispute about that. And have you read the recent case law from Southland to do with their land and water plan?
I've read part of it, yes.
And Mr. Moore explored it with you, but with regard to the previous NPS for fresh water, it was clearly held there that Te Mana o Te Wai is intended to drive a paradigm shift.
That's right.
In thinking.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's my understanding from that case law, yes.
That's not new in terms of
this NPS.
The current NPS.
No.
All right. And in Otago, what you've got, both in practice and embedded in the planning framework, is a paradigm which is predicated on use and commoditisation of water, haven't you?
What was your response?
I'm still thinking the response.
Oh, still thinking. Okay. I was looking and I didn't know whether you had...
nodded or... no.
But it's an important question in Otago.
And I think the problem with the current planning framework is we've got objectives with no prioritisation of those objectives. That does not align with the NPS and the prioritisation in the NPS. My understanding of the architecture of the current plan was a lot of those natural values, cultural values, recreational values, a very wide range of values were intended to be protected through flow limits, through the minimum flows, and the schedule on how, I think it's a schedule or a method, on how minimum flows are to be developed, very much intended or sets out that those values are part of developing those minimum flows. And part of the critical problem is we haven't had those flows developed in all catchments.
And the reflection of that planning framework and its inadequacies could be encapsulated pretty neatly by the fact, according to your evidence, that 70% of the allocation for the Tairi River has already been reconsented under 35-year permits. Isn't that a fair characterisation of the current framework and its inadequacies?
So the reconsenting of those predates the NPS by quite some time, particularly the last two, yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'd say the vast majority of allocation within the Tairi predates possibly any version of the NPS, definitely the 2017 version.
Thank you. Now, in terms of the current NPS, it's a general proposition. You would accept that it gives significant prominence to the role of mana whenua in decision-making about fresh water, doesn't it?
Yes.
And it also gives prominence to the role of mana whenua in helping to define, along with the community, the values that are associated with water.
Yes.
And the role of mana whenua as envisaged under the NPS is both procedural in terms of engagement.
Yes.
And substantive in terms of outcomes, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. And the NPS is quite directive about this, isn't it?
Yes.
It must happen.
Yep.
Yes. Have you read the evidence of Mr. Allison, Mr. Fanga, and Ms. Bartlett?
Yes.
Given in this hearing? Yes. And is there anything that you fundamentally disagree with in that evidence in terms of their experience and their vision of the future?
Their experience to date,
yes,
in Otago?
Yes.
In terms of the specifics off the top of my head, I know Mr. Allison said that Runaka weren't consulted with. I disagree with that. We have attempted to consult and engage with local Runaka, and we've tried to do that through Okaha and also through clients directly with local Runaka. They've been invited on site visits. They were invited to the Manuhiri Kia catchment field days that we held. And we did a lot of quite intensive work and quite fruitful work with Okaha, particularly a number of years ago, say with the Kai boom, also with the Lindis catchment. More recently, maybe in the last 2 years, it became very clear it became a policy that no more than that written approvals would not be given for consents of more than 6 years. This may have predated the time of notification of PC7, so that actually made consultation for the applications that we'd had in train, and we had some that had been lodged, for 3 or 4 years and had been working through them with affected parties. It actually made it difficult to try and find a pathway forward. And in some cases, we had written approvals from Ngā Rūnanga that were later, some 2 years down the track, withdrawn. And then when we asked for an explanation as to why, no explanation was given. So it actually made it quite difficult. And I understand that there are a lot of factors at play for Rūnanga with that.
Well, the essence of your answer is that Mr. Allison's wrong.
From my experience,
yes,
in terms of what we've tried to do.
Right. And let's think about how your framework might work in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the framework in your supplementary statement. You've got evidence before the court of an NPS implementation process which is happening at the moment involving Kaitahu,
mm-hmm,
and the council and members of the community. So that will carry on. It's an assumption. Yes?
Yes. Certainly hope so.
And a for instance is that some users will be seeking 20-year consents under your framework.
Mm-hmm.
How does your framework address mana whenua interests under the consenting process? How does it do that?
I've been quite upfront that it really, in terms of the discretionary activity pathway, that it's really targeted and focused on a particular set of circumstances, and I acknowledge fully that that doesn't fulfil the process or the substantive aspects that are required in terms of mana whenua involvement in developing the expression of Te Mana o Te Waia no Otago.
Yes. And so what would need to happen is one, notification whether full or limited of kaitahu.
Yeah.
And then consideration of an individual application and its particular context and effects.
Yes.
And involvement in that process through presentation of evidence.
Yeah.
And an exercise on a piecemeal or ad hoc basis of someone from kaitahu seeking to define Te Mana or Te Wai.
Yes.
For a water body.
Yep. Yep. And
through the consenting process.
Yes. Yep.
And is that, when you think about efficiency and effectiveness of rules and provisions, is that efficiency and effectiveness for all users and stakeholders?
No, we've already seen huge inefficiency and ineffectiveness in this process. And
I'll re-ask the question. When we are thinking about efficiency and effectiveness of plan provisions, should that be a measure for all participants in the process?
I would certainly like to think so, yes.
And under your framework, it is massively inefficient and a significant burden in terms of kaitahu resources to deal with individual resource consent applications, isn't it? In order to effectively participate in that process.
Yes, it is. And I'd also just add to that I think everybody's resources would be better actually put into the limit setting and the land and water regional plan, with the hope that we'd have that out in a timely fashion and that after the fact consenting could be more straightforward.
Yes.
Because I think for all parties, I agree, that would be a more efficient approach.
Right.
So this is really intended only as a backstop.
Well.
And a step in the right direction where it's needed.
But how is a 20-year consent a backstop to enable that process to occur?
It is linked into that into the aspect of I'll just pick up my wording, requiring investment.
I see. All right. Now, I've got some questions about your policy 10A.2.3, and you were in court yesterday when your counsel questioned Ms McIntyre, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And the suggestion he made to Ms McIntyre was that your policy 10A.2.3 does incorporate some aspects of the NPS. And I just want to double check, are we assuming, when you consider my next questions, that this is only for water bodies which contain threatened species and only degraded water bodies?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So, do you think your counsel said that, or what is your understanding of what he put to Ms McIntyre? Is it because one of the factors you've included in here is that the application, including the duration of any replacement consent, is consistent with any timeframe set out in the regional policy statement to meet Te Mana or Te Wai objectives relevant to the activity? Is that why your policy incorporates parts of the NPS, or are there other parts?
That's one part,
yep.
Yes.
And when you think about a Te Mana or Te Wai objective, what is that? Because there is only one objective in the NPS for freshwater management, isn't it? isn't there?
Yes.
And it effectively relates to mana or to wai.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry,
you carry on.
I was anticipating that could be read as objectives set out in the RPS to meet the objective of te mana or te wai.
And to the extent it deals with freshwater, every objective in the RPS would be a te mana or te wai objective, because that's the sole objective of the NPS, isn't it?
That's a good point.
Yes. And that's what the court found in Southland, didn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So what does this mean, then, in terms of the RPS? All the objectives of the RPS?
As they relate to fresh water, yes.
Yes. And you know, don't you, that while te mana or te wai is a te reo term,
mm-hmm.
it's not intended just for Māori?
No.
Yes. So it's water-centric, not yes. Māori-centric. Yes. So if I can ask you to, just on the same theme, turn to paragraph 29 of your supplementary statement. How do we know what the key aspects of the NPSFM to be given effect to? How do we know what they are? Aren't they all of them?
So key aspects in the context of what I've drafted are aspects that I think we can and potentially the duty to consider earlier rather than later. And so that's, again, Indigenous species degradation.
Right. And you gave an answer to Mr. Moore along those lines, that there's a lot of information and guidance in the NPS regarding national bottom lines that can be applied to deal with these key aspects, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yes. So when you look at the national bottom lines in the NPS, how many of them deal with water quantity and allocation?
That is a gap in the NPS. I do think some of them can now inform it in a more helpful way.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert on the science around this. And I think it's something that's potentially been grappled with for quite some time, because as I understood it, MFE has been working on the last version of the NPS, have been working on some, in my discussions with people from MFE, some more specific aspects to inform water quantity considerations. I'm just looking.
So is the answer then that the effectiveness of your framework to deal with the key aspects of the NPS is waiting on further work from MFE?
No. No, it's not. In terms of degradation, I think the links, if there are links between land use through the use of water, I think these bottom lines and the target attribute states are particularly useful. There's now also, I'm just looking for it, sorry, I think it's Appendix 2B, which potentially can be more helpful. And those are attributes requiring action plans, but they talk including 13 fish, so the integrity of fish communities, severe loss of fish communities. But again, I acknowledge I'm not an expert in the application at all of all those.
Right. Okay, thank you. Now, in terms of singling out threatened species, and in particular one threatened species, galaxids, were you in court yesterday when questions were asked around the Appendix 1A of the NPS?
Yes.
Yes.
To Dr. Olson, was it?
No, it was...
Oh, sorry.
Ms. McIntyre.
Sorry.
Are you familiar with Appendix 1A of the NPS?
Oh, sorry, I haven't caught the...
The compulsory
right
values?
Yes.
Yeah. And so what's the authority that you read in this national instrument for singling out threatened species in terms of dealing with compulsory values?
It is just one of a number of compulsory values that if it is potentially unrecoverable by doing nothing, and we have information that supports us to do something, and we can do that through a consent process, then I think it needs consideration.
Yes. All right. You're an expert planner, and so therefore the interpretation and application of planning instruments mm-hmm. is your expertise. What is the authority in this document or at law mm-hmm. for singling out one matter identified in Appendix 1A?
It will come back to the objective in the first tier, so the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. If there's something in a freshwater ecosystem that's at risk of being unrecoverable, then I think it's justified under that objective, and also Policy 9.
Okay. Well, do you think maybe compulsory value number 1, ecosystem health, might also be relevant and go into the mix?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, that doesn't just deal with threatened species, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No. Cute. Now, I was puzzled at an answer you gave to Mr. Moore, and you're expressing concerns about the uncertainty for users at the moment due to the shifting of the goalposts at the last minute. What are you referring to when you talk about shifting of the goalposts, and who shifted them?
I'm talking about the very strong clear messaging that's been coming from the Regional Council for quite some time about the replacement of deemed permits, plan changes that had occurred to the operative water plan in preparation for deemed permits, and that includes inclusion of provisions around water management groups, strong messaging and encouragement coming out of those policies and provisions around coming in as a group. It includes strong policy-based messaging around efficiency of water use and an operative plan that for many applicants, the thought that they would be replacing their consents under that.
Right. So, has the Regional Council shifted the goalposts, or is it the Minister?
Technically, it's the regional council because it's their plan.
Right. Now, I just want to shift to a different topic, and it's about the concept of allocation limits. Your framework doesn't refer to or have any recognition of the possibility of allocation limits, does it?
No.
Why not?
I think that is any change to allocation limits is in terms of actually bringing down actual use and a clawback, if that's what is going to happen, is going to be a huge exercise by the whole community. I think as a minimum, in comparison to that, flow limits can be a more, as a starting point at least, can rely on science to identify requirements for freshwater ecosystems. Yep. And that's the starting point again, because other values have to be laid over top of that. And they can also act as a critical component towards managing allocation. A flow limit can be seen as allocating or reserving water for values in stream freshwater ecosystem values.
Okay. In terms of the purpose of an allocation limit, I had understood your counsel as advancing the proposition that allocation limits don't relate to the Tier 1 priority under to mana or to why. Do you have that same opinion?
Not to this. I think they come into play. I think inevitably if you're allocating water, then that has an impact on ecosystems. It's the degree of that impact. Yes. So I think undoubtedly they come into play in terms of effects on freshwater ecosystems. They have potentially a lesser effect if you've got a flow limit in place which adequately protects ecology, and then the allocation aspect of it doesn't become as critical. It still does come into play though.
And you would accept, wouldn't you, that in terms of the health and well-being of water bodies, that that's just not that's not solely a scientific exercise, is it?
The health and well-being in terms of the Tier 1?
Yes.
No, I think other aspects come into play, but I think science is a critical component of that.
All right, thank you. And if you think about allocation limits, and in particular your reliance on Section 128 of the Act, you would agree that if there were allocation limits as well as things like residual flows and flow limits, that would make the review process more effective, wouldn't it?
Are you saying
if there were allocation limits set
in a land and water regional plan,
yes,
and then there are long-term permits requiring a review,
yes,
is that the scenario?
Yes, because that's what you are proposing, is that all of this can be fixed through the review process.
Not necessarily all of this can be fixed.
Right.
But the review process is a powerful tool that I think should be utilised, and it can help with the transition, the continued transition in the right direction. So it may be that limits are brought in, the time frame might extend past the life, the full kind of transition time frame to that might extend past the life of a particular permit, but there might be steps along the way, and the review could bring... They could either take a permit all the way if necessary, or they could step a permit in the right direction. It's a bit theoretical in terms of what we might get land, you know, what we might land on in a new land and water regional plan.
Okay. And you answered some questions from your councillor this morning about section 128, mm-hmm. and you gave some opinions about that. My understanding of your evidence was that you agree with Ms. McIntyre that there are significant legal constraints on what Section 128 can achieve in terms of it can't be used to change the location of take, and that it can't be used in particular to shift from a tributary to a main stem. Is that correct?
In part, it can't require it, but it can cause that to happen.
Sure. Yeah, that's the essence of it, that the availability of Section 128 can have consequential impacts rather than direct ones. So,
and within the context of those examples, yes.
Yes. And in terms of the strong policy direction, I think that or policy recognition of moving takes or supporting the moving of takes mm-hmm. from tributaries to main stems, mm-hmm. It's also the case, isn't it, that there's a permitted activity rule in the current plan for up to 100 litres per second from to be taken as a permitted activity from the main stem of the Kawerau and of the Mata'o and Lakes Wakatipu, Hawea, Dunstan, Roxburgh and Wanaka.
Yeah, I think that's yes. correct. Yes.
And why has that not been exercised significantly? Is it the cost factor of having to shift?
I think that has been exercised. Yeah, I know of quite a few users, I know of a lot of users who exercise or take water under that permitted activity rule.
Right.
Sometimes there are constraints. We've dealt with one recently where there was a trib that went into the Kawerau River, and we explored in quite a lot of detail the shifting from that trib into the Kawerau, and there were quite significant issues, and they included issues with gaining approval from Contact Energy and LINZ, flooding issues, sedimentation issues. So in terms of shifting the point of take to that larger water body, there were significant infrastructure and cost barriers to that. That particular user did have a permitted activity take as well. And the issues, they had the benefit. They were a party to the Contact Energy permit replacement process, which meant that they, as a result of their involvement in that consent replacement process, Contact are required as a condition of consent to keep rebuilding their take infrastructure every time it gets washed out. For a private individual to have to keep doing that whenever there's a flood through their sedimentation issues, it's incredibly cost prohibitive. So I think without that protection that Contact Energy consent gave them, they wouldn't be there taking water from that source. So there were some real barriers in a practical sense to shifting in that particular location more of their water that wouldn't therefore be protected by that contact energy condition.
Thank you for that example. If that's a single example of a barrier, then just how effective or how confident can you be that a Section 128 process is going to have the indirect effect that you suggest of shifting takes to a more sustainable location?
I'm not sure I suggested in the first place that a 128 might... I mean, it was Miss McIntyre's example of changes that might be required as a result to changes of allocation. So I'm just following through on that example. There are other places where it's entirely feasible, but I'm just saying that, you know, that sometimes there can be barriers to that. That's all.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
All right. So, question. It's 15 minutes past one, and I can say that we've now secured later flights out of Dunedin, which means that we would have to rise when? To catch a plane? What time do we have to leave here?
Sorry, Mum, just calculating in my head.
About three?
I think for the bench, if you were left by 3:45, you'd be okay.
Okay. Well, in route three-ish, and we'll firm that up. Witness needs a break. Yeah, I know. We'll firm it up with everybody. Yeah. Witness also needs a break rather than just pressing on with cross-examination. So we can continue past two, is what I'm saying. We'll post take half an hour. Lunch break, continue on. We haven't got, yet again, Forest and Bird's not in the room, but we've got Director General, Fish and Game, and the Crown. And I'm not cutting across your cross-examination. Again, it's a key witness, so how long do you think you need?
Mum, as I indicated earlier, I think a lot of the material I had in mind has been traversed. I would think no more than 10.
Okay. Don't feel like you're being pressed.
No,
we can look for other options you see next week if we can.
Certainly. And look, I don't have a great deal to cover with Ms. Dicey. I didn't have a great deal anyway to cover with Ms. Dicey. I really can't see it being more than 10 to 15 minutes. That does perhaps depend on the length of the answers.
Yeah. All right. Fish and Game.
Keep them short.
I thought you might be a bit longer.
Lots been covered, so probably a quarter of an hour.
Okay. All right, so we're looking at perhaps another 45. So if we take the adjournment now back at 2:45, that we should be done by 3. A re-examination? Yeah, that might take some time. Yes, that's true. Okay, so, but again, you know, the critical point is, you know, if we have to hold the witness over on her oath, we will look for time next week, if we can find time next week. It's not ideal for anybody, but especially it's not ideal for the witness. But that's what we'll do. So, you know, your options are open. I'm not wanting to cut across anybody's time. Court can save its questions for another day.
Yes. The only logistical problem for the witness that I would flag about holding her over till next week, we've got the 1st of April arriving next week, and there's a mountain of applications that I think the witness and her team need to get lodged with the ORC. So
she's got a team. There's only one of her, and she's the witness for your case.
But being incommunicado between now and the 1st of April is going to be a real difficulty for the witness and her clients.
I know.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. So think about that. There'd be somebody that you know if there's some actual immovable impediment if we can't finish today. Okay? So half an hour back at 2:15.
All right.
She's able to have lunch.